From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Sunday night is the finale of the TV show The West Wing. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we look back at 7 years of quick-witted scripts and top performances with cast members Bradley Whitford, Alan Alda, and the late John Spencer. First, Bradley Whitford tells us about playing Josh Lyman, the Deputy White House Chief of Staff on the NBC drama. Alan Alda talks about playing Senator Arnold Vinnick, and we'll listen back to an interview with the late John Spencer. He portrayed Leo McGarry. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Down in the Valley, starring Edward Norton, David Morris, and Bruce Dern. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. NBC's The West Wing presents its final episode this Sunday, after 7 seasons on the air. The network is preceding this last hour of The West Wing with the very first hour, by repeating the 1999 pilot that launched the series. So today on Fresh Air, in addition to commenting on the way The West Wing started and is ending, we'll revisit interviews with some of its cast members, Bradley Whitford, Alan Alda, and the late John Spencer. The pilot of The West Wing was a brilliant hour of television, a virtually perfect TV pilot, introducing the characters, settings, and conflicts in one seamless, entertaining package. Aaron Sorkin, who created the series, wrote the script, and Tommy Schlamme directed it. That first West Wing introduced us not only to the primary characters, but to a previously unfamiliar acronym. In a key early scene, Rob Lowe, playing presidential advisor Sam Seaborn, has just spent the night with a woman he met in a bar. What he doesn't know until later in the show is that she's a prostitute. What she doesn't know until he gets an urgent message on his beeper is that he works for and in the White House.
How you doing, Sam?
Let me tell you something. The water pressure in here is really impressive.
I know.
You could run hydraulics in here.
You want some?
I'm fine.
I'm wasted.
And probably free of cataracts.
I get that. That's funny.
Thank you.
Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Your message, your pager went off while you were in the shower. I hit the button because I thought it was mine. POTUS in a bicycle accident. Come to the office. I memorized it just in case I raced it by accident. These things look exactly alike. Anyway, like I said, I'm totally baked, but, though it's not like I'm a drug person. I just love pot.
Lori, I have to go.
You're kidding me. It's 5:30 in the morning.
I know this doesn't look good.
Not that good, no.
But you know what? I really like you, and if you give me your number, I'd like to call you.
Stay right here. Save yourself a call.
It's not that I don't see the logic in that, but I really gotta go.
Because POTUS was in a bicycle accident?
Yep.
Your friend POTUS, he's got a funny name, and he should learn how to ride a bicycle.
I would, but he's not my friend, he's my boss. It's not his name, it's his title.
POTUS?
President of the United States. I'll call you!
That's how The West Wing started. How it has ended for the last season and a half is with a fascinating look at a presidential election from both sides of the political fence. Alan Alda plays the Republican frontrunner, Arnold Vinnick. Jimmy Smits plays the dark horse Democratic challenger, Matt Santos. Both of these tenured TV stars have been terrific in their roles. And as Josh Lyman, who handpicks Santos to run and guides his dark horse presidential campaign all the way to victory, Bradley Whitford has been the real star of this final year of The West Wing. Certainly, he's the one original cast member who's gotten the best storyline and done the most with it. When Josh melted down trying to track the anomalies of the vote on election night, Whitford's portrayal was equal parts passion and panic and was unforgettable. Terry spoke with Bradley Whitford 4 years ago. At that point on The West Wing, Josh's problems and Whitford's performances were just as memorable as they've been this season. Josh was Deputy White House Chief of Staff then, and CJ, played by Allison Janney, was the press secretary. They're discussing the crisis of the moment, which is typically complicated. President Bartlet, played by Martin Sheen, is about to go public in a nationally televised interview with the formerly secret news that he suffers from multiple sclerosis. CJ and Josh don't know how he'll break the news, or even how he'll answer the question about whether he'll run for re-election.
We'll call them answer A and answer B.
Yeah.
Mr. President, does this mean you won't be seeking a second term? Answer A is you bet. I will absolutely be seeking a second term. I'm looking forward to the campaign. There is great work that is yet to be done.
Yes.
Answer B.
Are you out of your mind? I can't possibly win re-election. I lied about a degenerative illness. I'm the target of a grand jury investigation, and Congress is about to take me out to lunch. I'd sooner have my family take their clothes off and dance the tarantella on the Truman balcony than go through a campaign with this around my neck. You think that's too on the nose?
I do.
Brad Whitford, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you. It is such a joy to be here.
Well, President Bartlet is about to publicly disclose that he has MS, and we and his staff are kind of waiting to find out if he's running for re-election or not. Any clues what we're in store for tonight?
I can tell you that nobody knows in the cast. I don't think Aaron has made a final decision yet, and there are actually more ways that this could go than one would think. So there's a big question for Bartlet as to whether an election is viable now. And there's a question, I think, for Martin Sheen about whether he wants to do a TV show.
Uh-huh.
Ooh.
Well, here's the problem. If President Bartlet decides not to run again and Martin Sheen decides he doesn't want to do a TV show, like, you and the rest of the White House staff are kind of out of a job, aren't you?
Well, there are a lot of scenarios that could remedy that. We have a very tricky vice president, of course. Hoynes, who we don't quite get along with. Things could happen to Hoynes. I've always kidded Tim Matheson that he's a heartbeat away from a regular. So there are all sorts of things that could happen. It's very funny because we started doing this show a year into our term. And when a show does as well as this has, which has really shocked us all, I think we all thought it would be maybe a snooty little critic's darling. But when a show does this well commercially, they start to look way down the road. They're looking for ways, you know, either we may have to change the Constitution to get to syndication.
Last season ended with a would-be assassin shooting one of the members of the White House staff. It was a cliffhanger ending, and we didn't know who was shot until the first episode of the new season. That person turned out to be you. When mm-hmm. did you find out that you were the one who was shot?
Well, I was... we were shooting the final episode of the first year, and we were at the museum in Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C. And the way we shot it, you would just hear the shots. You were screaming gun, and there was chaos, 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 and nobody knew who was going to be shot. And Aaron just kind of casually walked by me and said, it's going to be you.
tag, you're it.
Tag, you're it. And then it was very funny because I kept the secret even from my mother, who actually... lives in Philadelphia, and it was very funny because when the show, the second season premiered, I was at work, and it was about 6 o'clock, and the show was on at 9 in Philadelphia, and I said, I just want to listen to the teaser with you, so stay on the phone, and she said, oh, my goodness, they shot Martin, because they revealed that the president got shot. And then when it was revealed that I was shot, she said, oh, dear, I have to hang up now. And she hung up on me.
Now, why did you have to wait till the night of the broadcast to tell her? Why couldn't you tell her before?
I just thought that she would enjoy the experience of the show a little more.
You weren't afraid that she'd take it to the New York Times and spill the secret?
Well, she's got a mouth on her. Yeah, she... She basically walks around Philadelphia with a sandwich board on her back saying, my son is on the West Wing. So she was not somebody I wanted to tell.
Now, when Aaron Sorkin told you that it was your character who was shot, did you think, well, that's a good thing. You know, now you'll have more kind of subplots and your character will be the center of attention for a while. Or did you think, wait a minute, what if the character dies?
Well, I was fairly confident that the character was not going to die. It was fairly clear that this was not a good time to renegotiate. but I was actually quite honored by it because it was an important event in the show. And it meant a lot to me that I think part of the reason Aaron did it was because he felt like people would not want you to be shot. And it felt like a compliment getting shot.
Well, your character healed pretty quickly physically, but you became a little edgy, a little paranoid, and started behaving kind of inappropriately. And in the Christmas episode, the chief of staff actually sends in an expert in dealing with post-traumatic stress syndrome to help you out.
Yeah.
And so let's hear a scene that's an example of why the White House staff was so worried about you. Here you are in the Oval Office with the president and the chief of staff, behaving quite inappropriately.
Can I say I think it's a bad idea?
Why?
It's not something Didion's going to like.
Well, I'm just talking about a meeting, but if I decide to do it, the president controls the SPR, not Congress.
Yeah, but Didion controls the IMF vote.
Two aren't related.
Let's move on.
The two are related.
How?
Through Didion.
I'm saying the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and forgiving the IMF debt are not related.
Anything else?
Of course they're related.
Josh.
If Didion doesn't like that we're tapping into the SPR, he's not going to let the IMF debt out of committee.
We'll talk to him tonight.
Mr. President.
At the Christmas party, we'll take him aside.
No, sir, you can't just take him aside.
Josh, we can move on.
We can't move on from
Josh.
You. We can't just take him aside. If we tell him we need his help, then we give him visibility and power, and we put him in a position to say no and be a hero to his party. And who wouldn't want to do that for a living?
Josh, Didion's a good guy. We can talk to him.
You need to listen to me. You have to listen to me. I can't help you unless you listen to me. You can't send Christmas cards to everyone. You can't do it. Forget the SPR. Let's get the IMF loans like we said we were going to. Listen to what I have to say about Didion, and please listen to me.
Josh.
All right, let's move on.
Josh, go in my office, would you?
Suppose if it's just a meeting.
Wait in my office, would you?
Okay.
That scene is really kind of out of character for you, which is why they sent in the traumatic stress expert. But as an actor, it must have been interesting because it gave you a chance to show a different side of your character and of yourself.
Yeah, the challenge in that episode was to get a Josh that could conceivably get through the day, who wasn't clearly nuts, but there was something very dangerous going on with him. It was difficult dealing with. The most interesting thing was to deal with his attempts at humor, which are a defense mechanism for Josh, and something he's very, very good at. And in this particular episode, it was very tricky trying to sort of find a way to do his humor in a way that simply did not work. It was very difficult to scream at Martin that way because he just looked. He looked heartbroken, and I adore Martin. It was a very difficult thing to that inappropriately explode.
Bradley Whitford speaking with Terry Gross. We'll continue our tribute to the West Wing in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to our interview with Bradley Whitford, who plays Josh Lyman on The West Wing. The final episode of the series airs on Sunday after 7 years on the air.
The West Wing started in the Clinton era and was perceived as an idealized version of the Clinton White House. Now that Clinton is out and George W. Bush is in, do you think that there's been changes on the script, or are you expecting changes in the series to kind of reflect that there's a Republican White House now?
No, first of all, we were clearly not Clinton. Bartlett is clearly not Clinton. He is a progressive Democrat. I actually think that the current scenario is for the show. This is different from what I think would be the best thing for the country. But for the show, I think that the current scenario is actually the best, because it would have been awkward if we were portraying a progressive, heroic Democratic president in an era where, you know, Ronald Reagan won in a landslide. We would have been sort of anachronistic, I think. But now we're able to be a kind of a contrast. I also believe that I think there's something inherently heroic about a progressive Democratic president. And I don't think our show would work if at the end of the hour the music swelled and we were all, you know, jumping up and down in the Oval Office saying, you know, hey, we're drilling on protected lands. you know, we got the huge tax cut for the top bracket. You know, I just don't think it would work.
How closely do you watch the White House, and how closely do you watch your counterpart in the White House?
I watch it very carefully, actually. I mean, I follow in the papers. I have spoken to Josh Bolton, who is President Bush's deputy chief of staff, and I've spoken a lot to Steve Ricchetti, who was President Clinton's chief of staff. In each White House, the roles of deputy chief of staff or chief of staff have many different responsibilities. On our show, we should have a show that has 40 characters in it. There are so many roles in the White House that we dramatically cannot cram into a one-hour show. So my deputy chief of staff, you know, is actually down on the Hill cajoling representatives and senators, and you know, I'm meeting pollsters at the airport. I'm doing a lot of the things that would be a little more farmed out in the actual White House.
I know that there have been episodes of The West Wing that have been loosely based on things that have actually happened. I'm wondering if the opposite has happened, if you've done episodes and then watched the real version of it later play out at the White House, and if so, if you were watching carefully to see how the deputy chief of staff at the White House was dealing with it.
How he was reacting to it?
Yeah.
You know, there's actually a rumor, and I don't know if it's true. We did a thing about the Antiquities Act, where the president was trying to preserve a piece of land, and there were some difficult negotiations with the Senate. At the last minute, I pulled up the Antiquities Act, and we used it to preserve this land. And there is a rumor that some people in the Interior Department sort of picked up on that, and that some of the Clinton antiquities actions were the result of that. But I don't know if that's true.
Has anyone from the White House ever called you up and said you got it right or you got it wrong?
Yeah, I'll tell you. Last night I was sitting with Aaron, actually, here in New York, and a guy from the State Department came up and said that we had gotten a situation, a hostage situation in Colombia, absolutely right. He had dealt with one and was amazed at how accurately we had portrayed the situation in the Situation Room and the situation in Colombia. And that's always shocking. Shocking to us. I mean, what is surprising is the people in Washington have taken it, from both sides of the aisle, have taken it much more seriously than we expected. I think partially because we are not portraying them cynically. Usually politicians are either saints or buffoons. But we're portraying smart people in making very difficult decisions. But the other thing is that we didn't anticipate was the power of... we did a show about the census, where there was an argument going on between computer sampling and head counts. And this is a fairly esoteric policy argument that most people don't think about. And we were able to get the bullet points of both sides of this argument across to 18 million people in the course of doing a show that our intent was not to feed America their vegetables and give them a civics lesson, but to entertain them. But in the course of that, you know, we happened to get this across. And people in the White House have said that's an incredibly powerful thing.
Well, Brad Whitford, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Bradley Whitford, speaking in 2001 with Terry Gross. We'll have more of our salute to the West Wing in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Turner Classic Movies, presenting Race and Hollywood, Black Images on Film, a 38-film retrospective with discussion and commentary Tuesday and Thursday nights in May. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our tribute to the TV series The West Wing. The first and the last episodes air Sunday on NBC. We'll hear from Alan Alda, who played a Republican senator, and the late John Spencer, who played the president's chief of staff. Also, David Edelstein reviews Down in the Valley, the new film from writer and director David Jacobson. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's show, we're listening to interviews about The West Wing as a salute to the show going off the air Sunday after 7 years. Last fall, at the beginning of the final season of The West Wing, guest host Dave Davies spoke with Alan Alda, who had taken on the role of Republican presidential hopeful Arnold Vinnick. While running for president on The West Wing, Alda also won rave reviews and a Tony nomination, playing the desperate salesman Shelley the Machine Levine in Glengarry Glen Ross on Broadway. After all those years as Hawkeye on MASH, Alda couldn't have hoped to find an equally meaty and challenging role in a TV series. But as Arnold Vinnick on The West Wing, he did. He came to The West Wing acting more like the show's star than a guest star, in a part that called for precisely that. Here's a scene from early in this final season of The West Wing. Vinnick is meeting with President Bartlett, played by Martin Sheen, to work out a deadlock which has occurred in the Senate. The Republicans want a bill on the national debt ceiling, while the Democrats want to raise the minimum wage. Vinnick has come to the White House to negotiate.
Mr. President, I'd hate to think that you were consulted by Democrats on the Hill about doing something as irresponsible as playing games with the debt ceiling.
Have a seat.
But I'd like to think they'd follow your leadership if we could agree on a way out of this mess.
You came to the right place.
Good. What did you have in mind?
Democrats withdraw the minimum wage amendment from the debt ceiling bill. You pass the bill, then you give them a vote on the minimum wage.
You'll lose a vote on the minimum wage.
We might be able to shame enough Republicans into doing the right thing in an election year.
How about you withdraw the minimum wage amendment? We pass the debt ceiling clean, then I round up enough Republican votes to pass the minimum wage increase.
You can get that done?
We have Republican senators in 7 states with higher minimum wages than the federal level. California, it's $1.50 higher. We don't want jobs moving to lower wage states. I can get you the votes.
What do you want from me?
I announce the deal.
I know a few Democratic candidates for president who wouldn't be happy watching you take credit for this.
Well, then let them pass the debt ceiling for you and get you the minimum wage increase.
Anything else?
Help me keep a secret.
What's that?
That I just gave you more than you asked for. Let me hang around for a while. As if we're really slugging it out in here.
Can I get you anything?
Where's the ice cream?
My guest Alan Alda playing Senator Arnold Vinnick on West Wing. You know, it's interesting because in Glengarry Glen Ross, the Broadway play, you play kind of a guy who's sort of desperate, pathetic, struggling salesman. Here you're a guy who wields power with such ease. Tell us about getting into that role.
I just shook hands with the part of myself that's powerful and at ease with it. It's actually fun to get to be different kinds of people. I've always enjoyed playing somebody more powerful than myself and more at ease in an emergency, more of a leader and that kind of thing. And I found even in my 20s, when I would play a part like that, I somehow was able to take on those attributes in my normal life. The bad parts of the characters I played haven't stuck with me. I haven't gone on to be a homicidal maniac after playing one. But I did take on some of the stronger qualities. I think somehow playing it out, having the freedom to play it out and feeling the pleasure of it has sometimes allowed me to do it in real life. But it's not as if it wasn't there in the first place. That's the interesting thing about this process, this profession. You look inside yourself and find out, very often you find out what has been in there all along that seems so different to you and so alien to you. But we're made up of many different parts.
Does your wife, Arlene, know when you've brought a piece of a character home with you?
Yeah, unfortunately, while I'm playing the part, sometimes it shows up in the negative side of it shows up in daily life. While I was doing Glengarry Glen Ross, I was cursing a lot. You know, I'd go to hang up a jacket in the closet, and it would slip off the hanger. And you would have thought that I was being accosted in an alley, and I was fighting for my life. And I'm cursing and screaming. And she said, what? I said, a hanger fell. And she said, boy, I can't wait till this play is over. Because I was the guy all the time.
Alan Alda speaking last year on Fresh Air with Dave Davies. We'll conclude our salute to the West Wing with the late John Spencer, who died suddenly last year after suffering a heart attack just 4 days shy of his 59th birthday. Spencer's great strength as an actor, portraying White House Chief of Staff and vice presidential nominee Leo McGarry, was to convey, all at the same time, a sense of intelligence, a sense of urgency, and a definite sense of humor. On the page, many of his lines, especially the ones written by series creator Aaron Sorkin, may have looked almost minimalistic. But like the dialogue of David Mamet, The West Wing has a definite musical rhythm to its speech. And John Spencer was a virtuoso at hitting all the right notes. Here he is talking to Josh, played by Bradley Whitford, in one of those familiar scenes where the characters trade lines while marching briskly through White House corridors. In backstage West Wing shorthand, these are called walk-and-talk scenes, and Spencer was brilliant in them.
You wanted me?
Yeah, it's all set up.
The meeting?
Yeah.
This is great. Good is gonna come from this.
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah, but how often do you get to...
Yeah.
When's the meeting?
Day after tomorrow.
You're kidding.
No.
Perfect.
We wanted to do it right away.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
Nothing.
What's the problem?
There's a woman I've been...
Amy Gardner.
Yeah.
I hear things.
I know.
I try to forget them quickly, but...
We were supposed to... This is ridiculous, but we were supposed to go away.
Where?
It doesn't matter. We just... We've been having trouble getting together. Day after tomorrow?
Go.
I can't.
Go.
I need a beer for this.
No, you don't.
Don't worry about it.
My wife lives in my house. I live in the hotel. And this is why.
Yeah, okay.
John Spencer won an Emmy for his role as Leo. He also co-starred on L.A. Law and made his first movie appearance in War Games. As a teenager, he was featured on The Patty Duke Show as British cousin Kathy's boyfriend. He acted often on stage, and his other film roles included Presumed Innocent and The Rock. Terry spoke to John Spencer in April of 2000.
Your character is a former alcoholic.
That's right.
Who hasn't touched a drink for several years. I forget
right.
How many.
8.
Recently, the fact that he had been to a rehab center was made public by a kind of new aide in the White House. So mm-hmm. Someone who is very young and very new to this kind of job. Was she an intern?
She was an intern.
Yeah, she
worked,
an intern. Okay.
Yeah, she worked in the administration office. She really didn't work in the West Wing itself. She was in administration, but that gave her privy to files.
Well, so she secretly makes this file public, you know, that you were in rehab.
She leaked it to a friend socially.
Yeah.
And who was in the opposite political party, and he took the football and ran with it.
And it gets into the press, really big story.
Absolutely.
Very difficult for the White House to handle.
Absolutely.
One friend of yours suggests that you resign. He's no longer your friend, I think.
That's right.
And then when the story is traced back to the intern, she's fired. She comes into your office because you've mm-hmm. invited her in.
Mm-hmm.
You talk it through, and then you tell her to keep her job.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, I wonder.
Yeah,
chief of staff would really say to the intern who leaked something like this, go ahead, keep your job.
Mm-hmm. Being in recovery myself for 10 years, I kind of have an intimacy with the rooms, with AA. And one of the precepts of the program is forgiveness and lack of proselytizing. Share your story. Don't do inventory on other people's points of view. Love and forgive constantly. And I think the turning point for Leo, which I had to find as an actor, I think it is a conversation. He plans to fire her. He asks her why she's done this. And in questioning why she did this, when she comes out with the fact that her father was an alcoholic and his irrationality and strange behavior was so aberrant to her, so horrifying, that this was the only other alcoholic she knew, and suddenly finding out that the chief of staff of the White House of the United States was also an alcoholic, her only point of reference was her old man, was her dad. And I can't imagine how horrific it must have been for her, thinking someone with these mood swings, someone who might act like this, is in such a seat of power where people's lives could be affected. And as she expresses that, I think myself as Leo have to realize, well, the motivation is a positive one. The result might have been horrible for me and for my friend the president and for our administration. But this woman, it was not kind of nasty, you know, water cooler gossip. It was someone who really feared that it could be very dangerous and to have a man with this weakness or this problem in this important position. And when I see that and I kind of note that She has a love of the government and a love of its responsibility, feeling that she was well motivated. I think I have to give her a second chance. And God knows my character's been given through his life a lot of second chances. So how can you get and not give, you know?
Was the chief of staff character originally written as a recovering alcoholic, or was that aspect of his character written in after you got the part because of your own experience?
Yeah, good question, and often asked me. The truth of the matter is, it was not originally written that way. I have since, because I've been asked this question so many times, gone to Aaron and said, listen, how much did my life influence you there? Because we've talked very rarely about it. I mean, I remember one time going into the soundstage, and I was yet struggling again with the cigarette, no cigarette thing. And we were talking about addiction, and I said, well, this is the last threshold for me, and this is the hardest. And then I started talking about being in recovery. And I don't know if he knew about it before then or not, but it was a very light, casual conversation. And since the episodes have aired that cover this, I've been asked that question a lot because I'm not anonymous and people know that I'm in recovery. So it seems like the obvious question. So I went to Aaron and I asked him if my life influenced his desire to put the character that way. And he said, absolutely not. He said, you know, it was part of his creative imagination, part of his own life experience, knowing people in recovery. And I triggered it off by saying I was in recovery, but he was not basing it on my life.
In TV, you're best known for your roles on L.A. Law and The West Wing. But your first recurring TV role was on The Patty Duke Show.
It certainly was.
As Kathy's boyfriend, the British identical cousin.
The British identical cousin, I forget, what was the role called? Henry Anderson, I think, was the guy's name.
You don't even remember.
Well, I was 16. I'm 53 now, so it was a while ago. Yeah. Well, what a lucky stroke. It was one of the first jobs I ever did in the show business, and it was a lucky break. I mean, they were basically casting what they saw is what they got. I had no training at the time, and I guess there was something in my personality that they thought suited that character, and they just hired the man to play the character the way they wanted, and that's what they got.
Why don't you refresh our memory and describe the character?
Oh, he's kind of goofy. It was, kind of a typical teenager in the 60s. I watch some of the reruns every once in a while, and I look particularly tall and skinny to myself with very big ears and kind of voice that cracked as it got up in the higher register. So it's almost at times if I see that, like I'm watching a different person, you know?
Were you in it from the first episode, or was the character written in later?
It was recurring. I was in the first episode, and I say I would maybe did 10 or 15 of the 22 of the first two seasons. And then the show moved to California because Patty turned 18, and it was working codes and things. She was not under the child labor law any longer, so they could easily do the show in California. And they didn't take any of the recurring people with them to California. So I was only on the first two seasons.
Did she get a new boyfriend?
Kathy? Kathy kind of played the field, as I remember.
She was such a swinger. No, she wasn't.
No, she wasn't. The other one was.
Yeah.
Do you remember the theme song?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I do too.
Why don't you sing it? I'm not going to.
I can't sing it. I won't go near that. But it's amazing how many people do.
The late John Spencer speaking in 2000 with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with the late John Spencer, who played White House Chief of Staff and Vice Presidential candidate Leo McGarry on NBC's The West Wing. We'll pick up where we left off, when they were discussing his recurring role as a teenager in the 1960s on TV's The Patty Duke Show.
For a lot of people who grew up with the Patty Duke show, they probably thought that, like, one day they'd be old enough to go to the malt shop with a date.
Oh, I know.
And, I mean, did the whole idea of what being a teenager was on the Patty Duke show affect your idea of what it meant to be a teenager?
We were kind of different teenagers, a little more jaded, a little more worldly wise, a little more out there. Because we had no time to go to the malt shops. We were either at the studio or trying to make up homework.
I'm not sure you could have found a malt shop like that in Manhattan.
We had a place called Rudley's, which was right by the school. It was a coffee shop. No longer there. The Gulf Western building is there now. And we would often, I'm talking out of school here, Terry. We would often cut classes and hang out there and drink Coca-Colas and eat English muffins and smoke cigarettes. A habit that I picked up early on and I'm still trying to get rid of.
It's hard. It is really hard.
Oh, boy. It seems to me my Achilles heel. This is now my third attempt. I stopped for 18 weeks and then very cavalierly over Christmas decided, okay, I'm strong. I'll have a few cigarettes. I'm on vacation. Well, there was a really stupid point of view because within 3 or 4 days I was smoking completely again.
So you're trying to stop again?
I've just been hypnotized. That was not the greatest tool. So I'm going to go back to the patch and Zyban, which I used and kept me free for 18 weeks. Actually, I used them for 12 and 6 weeks. I was totally clean. So well, I know that to work. So I'm going to try that again.
Your character on West Wing doesn't smoke, does he?
Not at all.
That's good because you wouldn't have to smoke. You wouldn't.
No, I
that
made
would really
that
hurt
as
to have to smoke to be in character.
Absolutely. I made that as a conscious choice. Also, the White House is a smoke-free area.
Of course.
So we'd have to run outside to have one. Do you smoke?
Oh, I gave it up a long time ago.
You did? How'd you do that? Cold turkey or did you use tools?
Well, I'll tell you what happened to me. I lost my voice twice on the air because I had a cold and I was smoking
right through it.
Yeah. And I realized, you know, this is going to be really awful if I lose my voice again like this. So that it definitely inspired me to stop. And I didn't. I just stopped.
You did?
Yeah, I mean, I was sick when I stopped. I had a really bad cold, no voice, so it was easy to get through that and then keep going. But I had stopped, you know, an amazing number of times before that and started again.
It's a squirrely habit. It really gets you.
It really
does. If I had to do it again, one of the regrets in my life is ever starting. And I remember my father, I was 15. We were in an airport, and I was running to get something, and I gave him my coat to hold. And I came back, and his demeanor had totally changed, and he had obviously gone in my pocket and found this pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
And we had this huge fight in the airport, I remember. And, of course, nothing he said meant anything to me. He was an old man with no knowledge of what I was going through. And I remember his words ingrained in my mind today of, you will regret this day, John, believe me. You will come to the point where you will wish you had never done this. And he was right. Father knows best.
John Spencer, speaking to Terry Gross in the year 2000. He won an Emmy for his role as Leo McGarry on The West Wing in 2002 and died last December of a heart attack. Spencer's unexpected death threw The West Wing into a sudden frantic rewrite phase. It's been reported that the original plan was to have Vinnick, the Republican, win the election. But once Santos lost Leo, the producers didn't want to have him lose the election, too. So a funeral is staged for Leo, and the sudden opening of a vice presidential spot on a newly elected ticket becomes one more hypothetical dilemma for the West Wing to explore. I've complained earlier this year about NBC pulling the plug on the West Wing too prematurely, and talked about how the battle for the presidency, between Alan Alda as Arnold Vinnick and Jimmy Smits as Matt Santos, has reinvigorated the show. So I won't go over that territory again, except to say that the recent plot twist, which had the Democratic Santos reaching out to the Republican Vinnick and offering him the position of Secretary of State, promised plenty of juicy conflict for the next administration of the West Wing. But at least we'll have a solid sense of closure. A show that began midway through the first term of the Bartlet administration, with Martin Sheen playing a thoughtful and passionate commander-in-chief, will end Sunday with a peaceful transfer of power to the new Santos administration. Since I don't have the power to give the West Wing a reprieve, what I hope most from Sunday's last episode is that Bartlet, in one of his final acts, gives a presidential pardon to Toby, his former staffer played by Richard Schiff. Toby took a principled stand over a national security issue and is facing a lengthy prison term unless Bartlett forgives him and steps in. He should. It didn't bother me when the gang from Seinfeld ended up in jail as the final episode of that show ended, but Toby deserves a better fate. So does The West Wing. When a show's ending is this good, maybe it shouldn't be ending. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Down in the Valley. This is Fresh Air. Writer and director David Jacobson won surprising critical acclaim for his 2002 biopic, Dahmer, based on the life of serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer. Jacobson's new film, Down in the Valley, also is a study of aberrant psychology. He sets it in Southern California's San Fernando Valley, where he grew up. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The love story, Down in the Valley, is both romantic and disturbing. More disturbing than romantic, actually, but the writer and director, David Jacobson, has caught hold of a romantic idea and done it full justice, how real love can bloom out of a mutual delusion. The female protagonist is Tobe, that's short for October, a California teenager played by Evan Rachel Wood. On a trip to the beach with her bubbly San Fernando Valley girlfriends, she gazes through the windshield of their car at the man pumping gas. He wears a cowboy hat and has a twang, and the other girls snicker. But something in her stirs. As played by Edward Norton, the man is rangy and diffident and soft-spoken. He tips his hat and says, "Ma'am." He's in a different universe from her widowed father, a conscientious but overbearing corrections officer played by David Morse. For his part, the cowboy, called Harlan, responds to the steadiness, the unvalley girlishness of Tobe's attraction to him. He thinks he can share his dreams with her, the dreams that take him out of the valley to the mountains, to the ranches and horses and trees above the smog line. Soon she's up there with him, captivated by his homespun poetry.
You think things have a purpose?
What do you mean?
You think everything has something it's supposed to do or be?
It's kind of a nice thought.
I sat here a lot of times. I looked at this tree. I wondered if that branch had a purpose. Maybe it's there to provide shade. Maybe it's gonna get cut down and make somebody a nice piece of furniture someday. Or maybe it's supposed to have a swing on it. I don't know, maybe it's just there so the tree can balance itself. I lean toward the swing. It seemed kind of hopeful to me. Now I see you sitting up there and I know I was right.
Down in the Valley sounds cornball, but without giving too much away, I'll say that director Jacobson's vision is harder edged than it first appears. When Harlan gives Tobe a ride on the horse of a rancher he says he worked for, their afternoon is so transporting that she can't even process it when the cranky old rancher, played by Bruce Dern, claims to have no idea who Harlan is, and then has him arrested. How can a man like Harlan exist in this day and age, when even the Western movies he seems to spring from are dead? And what about the flip side of his movie cowboy persona, the obsession with guns and gunfights? Jacobson's touch is so airy that no matter how creepy the undercurrents, you can't help but hope that Harlan is for real, at least on some level. And Edward Norton is a wonder. He gives his characters, even when they're twisted, an emotional purity. Tobe and her little brother, played by yet another Culkin, Rory, hunger for the hope that Harlan gives them. When the point of view shifts from Tobe's to her father's, Down in the Valley becomes increasingly surreal. The climax feels like a hallucination. It erupts on the set of a movie western, Harlan's last stand against the real world. The movie is enchanting, appalling, and like its central character, one of a kind.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. From Judy and Steve Hopkins, supporting the Shakespeare Theater's production of Pericles, May 25th through June 4th at the Carter Barron Amphitheater, Washington, D.C. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This month marks the 58th anniversary of the Arab-Israeli War. On the next Fresh Air, author Sandy Tolan tells us about the conflict through the tale of two families, portrayed in his book The Lemon Tree. Also, historian Neil Asher Silberman tests the historical accuracy of some of the Bible's oldest stories in his new book, David and Solomon. Join us for the next Fresh Air.